really look to do is have smaller shelters available. We try and house folks as close to their homes as possible. And this really was more of a evacuation site. The assumptions that were in place even a week ago when we were standing this up just have been completely overwhelmed.
We're here right now setting up cots for those people that were not able to get into some of the other shelters that were open.
We have made a request on FEMA for an additional 10,000 cots and additional supplies, and we have said that we need them to get here as soon as possible.
More than 32,000 people in the Houston area have fled their homes and are now in shelters. There are a couple hundred shelters set up, but the big ones are the convention center, the football stadium, a basketball arena. It's been a challenge, though, accommodating everyone. At one shelter, the Red Cross had to ration food. The convention center was set up to house only half the amount of people who showed up, some 10,000. Mike Morris is the City Hall reporter at the Houston Chronicle, and he's at the convention center. Hi.
Hi.
Can you describe the scene there?
Well, it's about as orderly as chaos can be, I suppose. There's just people moving in all directions. When I came in to attend the city council meeting this morning, city council doesn't usually meet here, but the city hall is partially flooded and had an electric short. So the council met here this morning upstairs from where the guests, the flood victims, are downstairs. Senator Cruz was surrounded by a gaggle of media when it came in. There's a lot of people outside. Having a cigarette. Some of them are able to joke with people they've met. Others look like they've been through a war, which, of course, they almost have.
Hmm. And what do they get when the storm victims, what do they get when they arrive?
Well, in the shelters that have it, they get a cot, they get a blanket, they get donated clothing. Hopefully, they fairly quickly get a meal. The city officials are continuing to ask for all of those items, some from government agencies and nonprofits like the Red Cross and FEMA, and obviously are asking for all sorts of items from Houstonians down to coloring books for kids. There's a lot of kids in the shelters. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the basic packet. There are kits the goal is to have kits for infants, that sort of thing.
And how long will they be there? Any idea?
It's hard to know for sure. The mayor said just a few minutes ago, you know, how long will the shelters be open? You know, as long as there's the need. But he is stressing that FEMA needs to work as quickly as possible, and city officials need to work as quickly as possible to start getting these folks into the emergency, the disaster relief system, get them temporary housing vouchers and help them get out. Of course, those are for folks whose, apartments may have flooded and that sort of thing. There are obviously folks who are going to want to get back to their damaged homes and try to salvage what they can. It's going to be a very long road.
How are people, I'm sure you've been talking to people there, how are they handling this, the fact that they are now homeless and living in a shelter?
You know, I think most of what my colleagues and I have encountered is just people who say they're grateful to have a roof over their head. There are so many stories of people being plucked by helicopters or what we call the Cajun Navy, people from the swamps of Louisiana who drove west with their watercraft to help out. They're pulled out of trees and off their roofs. And I think the overriding message you hear is just that people are happy to have a roof over their heads. But I think, you know, we know that will shift in the coming days. As Mayor Turner mentioned this morning, Houston is no stranger to floods. We had one last year. Once people are in a shelter for 4 or 5 days, you know, their patience, understandably so, starts to wear thin.
Yeah.
So we're sort of at that inflection point for a lot of folks.
Is there enough space for people? I understand that officials were turning people away at the convention center.
Right. There was a period where there was the initial plan to hold 5,000. There was a period that when 5,000 was reached, buses and dump trucks and the other vehicles that had gone through the high water to get people were being turned away. But the need became so great that they abandoned that plan and let more people in. The number swelled to 10,000 or more at one point. This morning it was down to about 8,000. There are, I'm told, enough cots and enough supplies here at the George R. Brown Convention Center now, and there are enough supplies nearby at the Toyota Center, which is where the Houston Rockets play, that the Toyota Center was opened last night as kind of a relief valve for the GRB, the Convention Center. And last night also the NRG Park, one of the county facilities near the Texans Stadium further south in the city, that was opened as yet another shelter that was, as far as I know, had enough supplies ahead of time to accommodate that. But these mega shelters seem now today to have the supplies they need. It's a bit more of an open question how the other various shelters throughout the city are doing. Obviously, there was a significant problem at the Greens Point shelter in the northern part of the city, where the initial plan was to hold 500 people, but they only started with 200 cots. And by the time they recognized that there were 2,000 people there Monday morning, they couldn't get supplies or cots in. People slept on the floor, covered in trash bags, trying to keep warm. Healthy adults were not allowed to eat. Meals were reserved for the young and the old and pregnant women. You know, some folks in Greens Point decided to stay in their flooded apartments because they'd heard how bad the shelter was.
This was a shelter being run by the Red Cross?
The Red Cross with city involvement, yeah.
Well, the Red Cross, and we're going to talk about that a little bit more coming up, has a long, long history of responding to disasters. Why was it so unprepared in this particular shelter?
Yeah, we certainly asked them that. One of my colleagues who was on the ground at that location talked to the shelter manager, and he said they knew we were out here. They knew what our count was. They were desperately trying to get things to us, but they couldn't. The orders were sitting in the trucks on the docks at headquarters, and at that point we had 3 to 4 feet of water in front of our building. So, we've heard the same things from Red Cross officials and from FEMA officials who also have a role in supplying the shelters with the commodities they need, that it's the same answer that I think we're going to hear a lot, because in some cases it's a fair defense and in others it's perhaps not, that this was the largest tropical storm to hit the contiguous U.S.
You got there, or your colleague got there. Other reporters.
Well, my colleague was smart enough to station in Greens Point before the storm hit because she knew it would flood. So I do think it's somewhat of a fair criticism as to why the responding agencies didn't stage the way she had, to be honest.
What's the story with evangelist Joel Osteen and his Lakewood Church? It was getting a lot of criticism online about not opening up its doors to shelter people.
Yeah, so there was a lot of criticism of that. I assume that part of that is based on the fact that that building used to be the Compact Center. That was where the Rockets used to play. It's a publicly financed building, which of course now is privately owned. And so, the Osteens came under a fair amount of pressure for not opening that. There was some confusion at one point as to whether the building had taken on any sort of water. Apparently, if it did, it was minor enough that they opened yesterday evening. And as I understand it, had ample volunteers on hand at that time, though it sounds as though they were working quickly to try to get enough cots and supplies for the people coming through the doors. I don't have a head count of how many people were there last night or this morning, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so 32,000 plus needing shelter. Is that number expected to go up?
Oh, definitely. I say that. Certainly there will be people fleeing their newly flooded homes. The water is settling into the bayous, and the bayous are settling into the rivers, and the rivers are rising and breaching their banks. And so areas that didn't flood when the storm came through with the first six bands of rain are now flooding because all of that rain wound up in the river that's near their house. And so those people are needing to take shelter for the first time. There's obviously the hope that people who had to flee previously will be able to leave the shelter. But I think that on balance, you'd have to imagine the net number is still going to rise.
Mike Morris, City Hall reporter with the Houston Chronicle. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's look at the Red Cross now. As we heard, it's been struggling to deliver supplies in some shelters. And as millions of Americans look for ways to help the relief effort in Houston, some people are saying, great, just don't give it to the Red Cross. The Red Cross has come under fire for its response to previous disasters, including Superstorm Sandy. Laura Sullivan is an investigative correspondent with NPR News, and she's done a ton of reporting on the Red Cross over the years. Hi, Laura.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thanks. Well, let's get to the broader concerns about the Red Cross in just a minute. But what have you heard about the response to Harvey?
So far, it's really just as the previous reporter was saying, it's really in this early stage where it shifts from the storm to the response. And I think it's now that we're going to start hearing the stories of where did shelters get the supplies and the food that they've needed so far. The Red Cross says it's got 300 trucks on the ground in the area, 200 serving food, 100 bringing supplies in. I think it's going to be interesting to see how the next few days pan out for them, because this is really where it's going to start showing whether or not they've had the supplies they needed in the place they needed before the storm even hit.
And are they saying how much money they've raised so far?
They are not. They have not said yet. They said that it's been too soon for them to count. It's an unusual response. I was in a top official who spoke with NPR this morning that it was in the millions, but they weren't sure yet. It's difficult to understand why they wouldn't know exactly at this point, but maybe somebody else at the organization knows.
Right. Okay, so remind us briefly about your reporting, your investigation, and what you found out about the Red Cross and how it spent its money and its time when it came to Superstorm Sandy.
So our investigation initially looked at its response to Hurricanes Isaac and Sandy and how that transpired. And what we found is that the Red Cross was spending and top officials and reporting and documents that we got from the Red Cross, they were spending significant portions of their time and effort on public relations rather than actually helping people. So in one case, we had a top official say that he had to divert 40% of his emergency response vehicles to press conferences rather than helping people. We had examples of truck drivers driving around empty trucks in Hurricane Isaac to sort of wave the flag of the Red Cross, even though they were empty and they had no supplies to offer people, but to make it look like they were actually providing services. We had meals that were going to waste, numbers that were completely blown out of proportion by the Red Cross, what they were saying, how many people they were saying they helped versus actually how many they did on the ground. And that was the initial part of our investigation. And then we started looking at their money. And that's where things got really interesting, because what we found, it's an organization that would not be transparent with us with all the questions we asked them about where did their money go. And they ended up reframing the way they always had said that 91 cents on every dollar you donate goes to services for people on the ground. They now say 91 cents of every dollar spent goes to people on the ground, which is kind of a sort of a mental mind twist that doesn't really get you to a real answer. And then our reporting eventually led to looking very directly at Haiti and finding out that through documents that they had to turn over to Congress, that actually 25% of the money that people donated, 25% of the dollar that was donated out of people's pocket went to internal Red Cross spending, never even made it to Haiti. And then on top of that, they partner with so many other nonprofits. So $1 went all the way down to three different nonprofit organizations. And when you got down to it, it was sometimes less than half, sometimes 40%, 30% of the money actually made it to a, of every dollar made it to a person on the ground in Haiti. So at the end of the day, they spent, you know, for Haiti, they raised $500 million and they built six homes. And most of the effort, the relief effort that they say that they provided in Haiti, we could not document in any way.
Wow. Okay. And so they had to testify before Congress, or Congress investigated. And of course, there was a, you know, your reporting and ProPublica. And so have they at all changed their ways since this all came out?
So this morning, a top Red Cross official, Brad Kaiserman, who's the vice president of the Red Cross, said that they are that they have shifted away. He acknowledged that this may that any practice they may have had of focusing on PR was no longer the case at the Red Cross, that they were spending every dollar wisely. It's difficult to tell. The Red Cross does not open its books for years anyway, for us. I don't know if that will change now, but they have not in the past. They have been very secretive about where the how they spend the money. And you know, it's been difficult also when you look at the number of disasters and storms that they've done. When they come out with these huge numbers of we're helping, you know, 32,000 people in shelters, or we're helping in Haiti, they said that they helped 4.5 million people. And when we asked the prime minister of Haiti, he said, we don't even have that many people affected by the earthquake.
Wow.
So that would mean they had helped every single person in Haiti. Yeah, so it was just, it was a lot of these kind of topics. I mean, in one report, we found that they were overcounting the number of people, undercounting the number of people who actually lived in an area. In one case, in Haiti, they said that they had helped more people who lived in this one area than actually lived there. So it's difficult to tell with some of the press releases that come out.
But still, you do have them, you know, providing some relief and some supplies and running some shelters, you know, in Houston. And so when people think, oh, well, where should I donate? Should they just not donate to the Red Cross? Should they look somewhere else, or what?
You know, it's not a question I can really answer. I mean, all I can do is say in the past where this money has gone,
yeah,
and attempt to describe where the Red Cross's priorities have been. The Red Cross's own internal documents from Sandy said that they had diverted assets during the storms to focus on their image rather than helping people. The Red Cross says that is not the case. That is not what they will be doing in the future, that they're on top of this. And that, you know, Brad Kaiserman said this morning that won't be happening on his watch, is what he said. So it's difficult to know. I mean, all you can do is research your individual charity, and see what you feel comfortable with. There is definitely a movement out there to donate directly to small charities, because in some cases, larger charities will simply take their 10% cut or whatever it is and give it to the smaller charity, who takes a cut, who gives it to the actual charity doing the work on the ground, who then takes a cut. And if you want to avoid all those cuts, you can donate to a small group who's already on the ground, you know, either in country or in city, that can help. But it's difficult. It's difficult to say. Do what you feel comfortable with, and try to read as much as you can about the organization you want to donate to.
All right. Well, thanks for your reporting on the Red Cross, because that sheds a lot of light.
Thank you very much.
Laura Sullivan, correspondent with NPR News and PBS Frontline. Coming up, she apologized, then she didn't, and now she's really not apologizing. Kathy Griffin on that infamous photo of her holding a mock severed head of Donald Trump and how that almost ruined her career. That story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Earlier this year, comedian Kathy Griffin published an image of herself holding the severed head of Donald Trump. It wasn't the real head, obviously. It was a mask covered in ketchup, but the backlash was fierce from all sides. Chelsea Clinton condemned it. So did her liberal friend Deborah Messing, Anderson Cooper. Griffin immediately took to social media to apologize.
I sincerely apologize. I am just now seeing the reaction of these images. I'm a comic. I crossed the line. I moved the line. Then I cross it. I went way too far.
But now she's reneging on that apology. Here's Kathy Griffin on an Australian morning show yesterday.
I'm no longer sorry. The whole outrage was BS. The whole thing got so blown out of proportion, and I lost everybody.
All right. We're going to talk about that with Yashar Ali, a freelance journalist. He recently wrote about Kathy Griffin for New York Magazine's The Cut. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why did she post this image in the first place? Was it to be funny? Was she making a political point?
Well, what she told me is she's a provocateur, like many comics are, and she wanted to send a message about what she saw as President Trump's sexism. And she chose to do a play off of his infamous comments about Megyn Kelly when he said on the Don Lemon show something like blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever.
I see. And then the reaction was fierce and swift, as I mentioned. Did she have any idea she was going to get that kind of reaction?
None. I called her right after the image was released by TMZ, and she said to me, oh, is it getting around? And I said, well, yeah, it's getting around. It sure is. And it's going to cause you a big problem. And, you know, she didn't understand at that point what the issue was. She's used to causing controversy, but she didn't realize that people would be, and I know this may be hard to believe, but I've spent 3 months talking to her, that people would be tying that to some sort of ISIS imagery. Because the thing about Kathy, like a lot of comics, she makes fun of certain things, but she doesn't really mean it.
Yeah.
And so she never thought that anyone would think of her as pushing something that ISIS or another terrorist group would.
Right. And, I mean, did she think, like, what would the reaction be if, let's say, a conservative comic like Dennis Miller did the same thing with the head of Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton?
I think that's, I'm just referring back to the conversations I've had with her. I think she thought that she was being a shock comic and sending a message, and she didn't factor in that people would see this as some sort of death threat. One of the things that she told me, and in retrospect, of course, she wouldn't have done it with a mask that looked like a severed head. She would have done it with a blow-up doll or done something else. She realizes now that that imagery didn't work for the message that she wanted to send.
And then she received a lot of unsolicited advice. And there's one particularly eye-opening piece of advice from Arnold Copelson, who's a movie producer, and he's on the board of directors at CBS. What did he tell her to do?
He suggested to her, actually, I shouldn't say suggested, he told her to send a letter that he had pre-written to President Trump directly to the White House, in which she groveled and begged for an apology and said that she's now seen the light and that she's been, blinded by the left. And he had told her that she should not release the letter to any other broadcast network except for the Fox broadcast network, referring, of course, to Fox News, and said that if she didn't listen to him, that her career would be over.
All right. So she didn't do that, but she did give a press conference a few days later. And here's a clip from that.
What's happening to me has never happened ever in the history of this great country, which is that a sitting president of the United States and his grown children and the First Lady are personally trying to ruin my life forever.
What is she talking about?
Well, she's referring to the fact that President Trump, of course, tweeted about the image that the First Lady, Mrs. Trump, had sent out a statement, and this was extraordinary, questioning Kathy's mental health. I spoke to a few presidential historians who have never seen, of course, a first lady release that sort of statement in modern times. This just doesn't happen. And of course, Don Jr., Eric Trump, and Lara Lee Trump, Eric Trump's wife, just going very public, attacking Kathy back for what they saw as an attack against their father. It certainly is extraordinary. That has not happened before. I mean, you didn't see George Bush serve as an attack dog for his father during his administration in the early 90s. You didn't see Chelsea Clinton do anything. She was an adult for part of the time that her father was in office. But, the key with that press conference is that what Kathy admitted to me is that she knew going into it was a mistake. She definitely knew it was a mistake leaving. She was desperate to get her message out. She felt like she wasn't being heard. She came across as defensive. She came across as a victim. And then she told me she's not a victim. She's still going to call out what she sees as bad behavior on the part of the president, but she's not a victim. She's very clear about that.
Right. And so that interview that she gave to Australian television yesterday, Sunrise, I think it's called, she's really now not portraying herself as a victim.
I know it's a mask covered in tomato sauce, but do you not accept that was a little bit over the line?
No, you're full of crap. Stop this. You know this. Stop acting like my little picture is more important than talking about the actual atrocities that the president of the United States is committing.
What I'll say about that interview is, and I can't speak on Kathy's behalf, I think what she meant was, based on my many conversations with her, including just yesterday, is that, you know, she's not interested in apologizing to the president. She had apologized, and I detailed this in my story, she had apologized because Rosie O'Donnell called her and said, what if Daniel Pearl's mother, you know, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was decapitated by Al-Qaeda, what if James Foley, another reporter who was decapitated by ISIS, what if their parents saw this? That's what led Kathy to apologize. And I know, because I asked her yesterday, that apology stands. She doesn't want, she told me, anyone that's faced this atrocity to have to, you know, deal with it because she put this image out. She feels terrible about that.
And so she's really saying that, look, this is a First Amendment issue and that other people could be targeted who couldn't defend themselves as well as she, and that, you know, she sees herself really as on a mission that's bigger than herself. But yeah. Is she also trying to salvage her career?
I think that she just wants to make people laugh. And it's not about money. I mean, money's obviously a byproduct, but it's about just doing what she does and she loves to do, and that's be on stage. I think there's a question here, as again, another topic that I discussed in my story about the import of discussing presidential power and the impact it can have on the arts and on reporters. You know, Kathy is very open about the fact that she's, you know, she's a wealthy woman. If she were a regular stand-up comic, I don't know that she could have weathered this. And there's a big question there to ask about, you know, whether the president should get involved in these sorts of matters.
Yashar Ali, his article on Kathy Griffin is up at thecut.com. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Edgar Arsenault never wanted to make art about race, but his latest work deals with a black actor performing in blackface.
I think in many ways, like we, you know, artists create taboos, and then we find ourselves attracted to the very thing that that draws great discomfort.
LA artist Edgar Arsenault next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brandt. And now, Blank Slate, our series about the artists who shape L.A. and who are shaped by L.A.
I said, let's make something that talks about Los Angeles as a place, about where you can go, the kind of cultural expansiveness of this city.
Immigration certainly plays a part. The idea of what is known as self-construction.
He was informed by a lot of things in L.A., whether it's the pattern and decoration movement or the women's building at CalArts.
Today, we meet the conceptual artist Edgar Arsenault in his studio. It's a large garage space behind his home in Pasadena.
Hi.
How you doing?
How are you?
Good to see you again. Hey, how are you?
Gina.
All right. So you guys got a real mobile operation here.
I know. This is
the dad and a microphone. And did you guys get a tour already?
No.
Arsenault grew up in South L.A. He went to art school here, grad school at CalArts. He teaches at USC now and runs a nonprofit in Watts. Arsenault's work deals with history and identity through drawings, video, installation. He leads us to a back room where a dozen antique law books sit, marinating in vats of sugar water. He pulls one out.
Yeah, you can touch them there.
Wait, you're growing sugar crystals?
Yeah, that's how these get on here. They're grown. It's an organic process.
I guess sugar is organic.
Yeah, it's organic. So, you know, it's part of the, you know, what I call like the kind of an embedded paradox when you think about crystals. Because, I mean, on one level, we think of them as being something which is frozen in time, right? But simultaneously, they actually grow organically like the roots of a tree.
The front of the book, where the pages are, is sealed shut with a thick bed of big white crystals. They're like literary geodes. The working title of the piece, The Crystal Paradox. The law books, the sugar. It's part of the larger question Arsenault has been exploring throughout his career as an artist.
When history comes into the present, what is it doing here now? And like, why does it resonate with us?
Those old law books, which once defined how people lived in our society, are now out of date. They're part of history. They are crystallized in time. Arsenault is interested in race and history and memory, which brings us to another project. It's a theater piece. It's called Until, Until, Until. And it's a reenactment of a performance at the 1981 inaugural ball for Ronald Reagan. Here's Johnny Carson introducing the original performance.
Ladies and gentlemen, as you, I'm sure you know, at the turn of the century, it was a segregated theater. And a black man, in order to appear at a white man's show, had to put on a black face so no one would know. And one of the giant stars of that era in the Ziegfeld was Burt Williams. And he kind of made fun of men's follies and foibles through his humor. And here tonight, to pay tribute to Burt Williams, is Ben Vereen.
So he walks out, he's in blackface, you know, he's got on this kind of oversized, you know, brown suit and a brown top hat. And he's performing as Burt Williams, and he actually sings the song Waiting for the Robert E. Lee.
What's this here? Why, it's the good ship Robert E. Lee, and it's coming!
And, you know, he's doing it in a kind of Bob Fosse, you know, high-kicking, happy hands kind of style, you know. And the performance is amazing, you know, it's incredible. And then once that ends, then the second act is where he, as Burt Williams, tries to get a drink from the bartender after the performance, in which he's denied access to that bar and told, essentially, you can't drink with us.
Bartender? excuse me. Bartender, yes, you, yeah. Set him up. No, sir, that's quite all right, sir. I'll just go get my place sometime.
So, you know, him trying to hold on to his dignity, you know, he turns around and then goes back to the dressing room and then sings another song, which is so heartbreaking and so moving that it, you know, it brings many people to tears.
What is that song?
It's called Nobody by Burt Williams, which is one of his most popular tunes. And, you know, and Burt was one of the most popular performers in America in the, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, both black or white. You know, he was just kind of a superstar. The most popular performers in America in the, you know, the beginning of the 20th century, both black or white. You know, he was just kind of a superstar.
Why did he want to perform that Ben Vereen in front of Ronald and Nancy Reagan?
He said that he felt that they needed to see it. He had just finished performing as Chicken George in Roots. He had just come back from Africa with Alex Haley and a good portion of the cast from that show, and was convinced that America was ready to have a conversation around race. But he also knew that Ronald Reagan had a long history as a conservative, that he was a union buster. You know, he had a very public fight against the Black Panthers, so he thought that this was a way to get Ronald Reagan to shift his economic policies. That conversation,
by performing this performance?
By performing this performance, which you have to see it, which we recreate in my play. Now, the reason why I decided to make Until, Until, Until as a play was because of the way in which Ben Vereen's life after that event of him performing in 81 had, you know, mirrored in many ways, you know, what had happened to a lot of blackface performers later on.
in their lives.
Here's what went wrong. As Edgar explained earlier, there were two parts to Vereen's performance. The first part, where he performs in blackface as Burt Williams, and the second part where, as Burt Williams, after his performance, Williams can't buy a drink in a bar because he's black. That second part wasn't shown on ABC, which was broadcasting the inauguration performances. So all people saw at home was Ben Vereen doing a minstrel show in blackface.
And he never got the opportunity to tell his side of the story because all of his friends, you know, they either abandoned him or they just stopped returning his phone calls. Or they came out and spoke against him publicly. And, he got death threats, you know, people spit in his face when he's walking down the street. Some of the most horrible letters that you can imagine, saying you've set the race back, 100 years. You know, if you can imagine that. The question is, why am I telling the story now in 2015, 16, 17? I was at a birthday party, which I jokingly like to say, you know, which I was not invited to. Who was sitting there but Ben Vereen. And I went over and I talked to him. You know, we sat down and we talked, and, you know, he said, you know what, I'll let you tell the story, but you just have to promise me that you'll never, that you won't allow that to happen to me again. And I said, I promise. And sort of with a deep breath, please, God, let this work out.
Do you think you, in a small way, rehabilitated his reputation by doing it?
Well, I can't take any credit for that. But I what I can say is that I think that now is that time when people are receptive in the way in which they weren't, you know, those 30-plus years ago. You know.
So what is the relevance of that performance today for you?
Well, I'll say it like this. I decided to tell the story not from a historical perspective, but to tell it from the perspective of how Ben remembers it, which is as a series of traumas. You know, so there's that old mantra that goes, you know, everyone and everything in my dreams is me. So when the audience is watching Until, I'm placing them squarely within Ben Vereen's mind, right? So one scene kind of slips seamlessly into the other, and it jumps through time. You know, it starts in 81, it goes to 2015, it goes back to 81, it goes to 1890, and it kind of moves and slips in ways that it's hard to figure out exactly what's happening until the end, where you realize that the show is actually about you, the viewer, the audience, slowly starts to realize that the camera that's in the room, that's training around on the performer, is actually about them becoming aware of their perception of that history, and then them literally being in the same room, in the same frame, with that 10-minute performance, they actually see themselves projected on the walls and on the curtains, merged with that audience from 1981.
It's powerful. So you said to me earlier that you don't consider, you're not like overly concerned with race, like you don't always want to talk about race in your work. And yet this piece is all about that.
Yeah, I know, right? How did that happen? Yeah, it's funny, you know, I joke with myself because I, when I was in school, because I went to school here in Pasadena, I went to Art Center College of Design, and I remember promising myself that I would never do anything that dealt with blackface because I just felt like as a symbol, it was like a black hole of meaning. Like either you were against it or you were for it. It's sort of like it forced you to kind of have a moral judgment. It's like the same way in which somebody deals with a swastika or a burning cross or an image of Jesus or something. You know, it's like, you know, it doesn't leave a lot of space for interpretation.
So when I'm standing there with Ben Vereen at this museum, which I wasn't supposed to be in, at this kid's birthday party, I'm thinking to myself, how did this happen? You know. And then when I'm directing a piece and a musical, which I don't like musicals, and here I am directing one, it just goes to show how funny life is. You know, you tell yourself you're not going to do something, and there you are square in the middle of doing it, you know. So, but, you know, actually the funny thing is I think in many ways, like, we, you know, artists create taboos, and then we find ourselves attracted to the very thing that that draws great discomfort towards us. And, you know, like James Baldwin said, you know, if you have a toothache, you need to pay attention to it, because if you don't, it's gonna kill you, right? And he was talking about the process of writing, that if you're, as a writer, you don't want to run away from the things that draw pain, but that you want to run directly towards them. And I was in a situation in which I could do that and then turn the audience's engagement with blackface into something that was, that could be interpreted, that could be meaningful in a way in which they hadn't seen it before.
That was artist Edgar Arsenault. His play Until, Until, Until is currently touring the United States. The next stop, San Luis Obispo. And his crystallized books will be shown at S.J. Quinney College of Law in Utah in September. This conversation is the third in our series on L.A. artists. It's called Blank Slate. You can see images of Edgar's work and the other artists in the series at kcrw.com/blankslate. Coming up, two fuzzy little bundles of joy, all snuggled up somewhere in the Santa Monica Mountains. Baby mountain lions, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Okay, we really need this right now. A story that's only purpose is to make you say, aww. Two more mountain lion cubs were discovered in the Santa Monica Mountains this week. Their names are P59 and P60. One's a male, the other female, and they are as adorable as you're probably imagining. They have big, bright blue eyes, tawny spotted coats, and oversized paws. Jeff Sikich is a biologist with the National Park Service in the Santa Monica Mountains. He says the cub's mom had been exhibiting what he calls denning behavior for about a week. The team waited till she was away one day to go check on the kittens.
As we're hiking in, only one of us will go in. It's usually pretty thick brush where these kittens are hiding, and they're pretty quiet until we find them and capture them. And then they'll hiss occasionally. When we're not around, of course, kittens will chirp and communicate with their mom that way.
Sikich declined to give us an example of what that chirping sounds like, but according to the Santa Monica Mountains YouTube site, it sounds like this. Sikich says the cub's mother is 2-year-old P53, and this is her first litter.
So it's always a great sign to see reproduction, of course, in this mountain lion population. So now it'll be extremely, you know, useful data to gather to see what happens to these kittens, especially as they grow older and disperse from mom at around a year, year and a half, and see where they go in this fragmented habitat we have here in the Santa Monica Mountains.
But he says the kitten's likely father could pose some long-term problems. Rangers aren't sure who the dad is. Just like any good episode of Maury Povich, the park still needs to perform DNA tests.
You are the father!
But Sikich says park officials suspect the father is P12, who also happens to be the cub's grandfather and great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather. For all of you Game of Thrones fans out there, that basically makes P12 the Craster of the Santa Monica Mountains.
He marries his daughters, and they give him more daughters. And on it goes.
That's foul. It's beyond foul.
Jokes aside, Jeff Sikich says this kind of inbreeding of the area's mountain lion population poses major problems for the cat's future.
With the lions in the Santa Monica Mountains, we have some of the lowest genetic diversity ever recorded outside that of the Florida panther. They're also seeing extremely low genetic diversity in the Santa Ana mountain lion population. So yes, eventually that is not a good thing. It can ultimately lead to no reproduction.
Sikich says over the next few decades, that lack of diversity could lead to their extinction in the mountains. He says it highlights the need for a wildlife path across Highway 101, which could help keep a better mix in the genetic pool. As for the new kittens, he says it's too soon to tell what inbreeding could mean for them. In the meantime, you can enjoy their ridiculous cuteness on our Twitter and Facebook at KCRW Press Play.
So I say D, I say D-O, D-O-D, D-O-D-G, D-O-D-G-E-R-S, team, 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 oh, I say O-M, O-M-A.
Oh yeah, little Dodgers music O-M-A-O. For you. Not really appropriate O-M-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L-A-L- fan, Uber fan. What's happening?
I know. They lost again, Madeline. That's three in a row, matching the longest losing streak of the year. They came close again.
Is it our fault because we started doing this segment and then they started losing?
No, I certainly hope not. They came close. They you know, at the end of the game last night, so they're still fighting, but another loss. But hopefully they'll turn it around.
Okay, but they're still 18 games ahead in the West, right?
Yep, best record in baseball. They've got a month to take it easy here before the playoffs. Nice place to be for a team.
All right, okay. Mm-hmm. Go Dodgers.
Go Dodgers.
Thanks, Mario Saavedra. All right, Christian Bordahl. You're going to round out the show here with some listener feedback.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, we asked listeners if they're giving to charities for Houston. We got a lot of negative feedback about the Red Cross. People saying they don't give to the Red Cross because they've seen how that money gets spent. We do, as we've mentioned the last couple of days, have some lists of places you can go to at kcrw.com/helphouston.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Christian Bordahl. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.